welcome to Clearer Thinking with Spencer Greenberg, the podcast about ideas that matter. I'm Josh Castle, the producer of the podcast, and I'm so glad you've joined us today. In this episode, Spencer speaks with Malcolm and Simone Collins about pronatalism, modernity, and encouraging diverse futures.
Malcolm and Simone, welcome.
Hello, it is so great to be here with you.
We love chatting with you, Spencer.
Oh, thanks. Well, I'm really happy to have you both on. And this time you're coming on at the same time, which should make for an interesting dynamic. And let's start with a topic that I know you're both very passionate about, pronatalism. So tell us, what is pronatalism and why do you care so much about it?
So the dominant social narratives around, I think everybody knows that birth rates are falling. And they know, you know, they've heard passingly that Elon Musk has complained about this or said this is something we should pay attention to. But I think the dominant narratives right now vastly undersell the scale of the problem and how quickly it is happening. And this can be found in many of the solutions that people propose to it. So, you know, most people know that the U.S. is under repopulation rate and has been for a while. That means that we are not having enough kids to replace the existing population. So under 2.1 kids per woman causes that situation. And then you will hear solutions like, oh, well, you know, we have a lot of immigrants from Latin America, so that should fix the problem. The problem, of course, being that all Central South America and the Caribbean combined fell below repopulation rate in, I think, 2019. If we look at all of the countries that we think of as being, or many of the countries we think of as being major places like with huge populations, like China, they're expected, but some estimates, to be at half their population within 45 years, and their fertility rate is falling this last year 13% year over year. India is likely to fall below repopulation rate this year. Over half of the world's population lives in a country that's below repopulation rate. And it doesn't appear that there's a floor as population declines. Like, no country has really flipped the script yet. And if you look at countries in more advanced states, like Korea, which is, you know, where I started caring about this, for every 100 Koreans, there is either, if you use the 0.7 or 0.8 number, 4.3 great-grandkids or like 6.4 great-grandkids. So like, no matter, and we are today where Korea was in the 90s. So, you know, this problem is really looming on the horizon, and we're looking at like a 94-93% population collapse. And very few communities, I mean, people think, oh, well, at least religious communities are immune to this, but it looks like in the U.S. that Mormons may be below repopulation rate already, or they'll be there within 5 years. And then even places that people think of as being traditionally, you know, high birth rate areas, like Iran, for example, people are like, well, at least Muslims have a high population rate. Iran, between the 1980s and 2010, fell from 6.5 births per woman to 2.5 births per woman, almost below repopulation rate, and at a rate faster than even China's birth rate fell during the one-child policy.
So where does this leave us with the world as a whole? If we look at the entire world, are we projected to have a shrinking population?
Yeah, so over the very long run, we are projected to have a shrinking population. And sorry, Titan Invictus, our third kid, is joining our call a little bit. So over the long run, yes, that is not our primary concern. So as pronatalists, we aren't saying that we need to have the entire world population grow as this never-ending pyramid scheme. We aren't necessarily running contrary to environmentalists who are concerned about the burdens that the human population places on environmental systems and other things. What we are very concerned about is future diversity and plurality. So while some populations are going to keep growing and we are going to have plenty of people in the future, what we're really concerned about is certain groups, like Malcolm referred to, basically completely disappearing, going extinct. So we could have a future in which maybe there are only like five dominant cultures that are out there in the world, and that worries us.
When she says certain groups, I think some people who aren't familiar with the data could think that she is dog whistling white Christians in America, when nothing could be further from the truth. If you look at the sort of ethnic and tradition clusters that seem to be most resistant to population collapse in highly prosperous countries, you're really only looking at white Christians and Jews. Specifically, what I mean by Jews is in Israel, Israel is projected to be one of only like four countries in the world that will be at a positive fertility rate at the turn of the century. And within the US, if you look at the rates of collapse, they are the slowest among the white Christian population when contrasted with the black population or the Hispanic population. And the white Christian population seems to have the largest population clusters of individuals who are able to maintain a high birth rate in sort of the face of modernity.
So obviously a lot can change in the next 80 years, right? The world can be completely different where all of our projections are wrong. But suppose we were to project out from here, just like our best projections of what the world will look like 80 years from now. Are you saying that it will be mainly Christians and then some Jews and then not very much of other groups? Or what are we actually predicting based on the data?
Two of the highest correlating factors with high birth rates are poverty and low female educational attainment. So one of our primary causes with prenatalism is to a great extent to protect women's rights and to make sure that the groups that are represented in the future aren't just impoverished people who don't support women's rights necessarily, to include a really broad group of people. Like, we don't just want the cultures and people represented in the future to be very against women in the workplace, very against female educational attainment, those sorts of things.
And to clarify what she means there, because this is coming directly after a talk of, you know, white evangelical Christians and Jewish populations, we are not saying that those communities are disproportionately against women's rights, but within any population group, the portions of that population group that are more against women's rights will have higher birth rates. And also, almost always within any population groups, the portions of that population group that are poorer will have higher birth rates.
So how does this interact with the claim that it's largely Christian groups and Jews that are having the highest birth rates?
So this actually comes to like our larger solution to this, right? So what we are saying is across every group, you see this, but certain traditions. So this comes to our book, The Pragmatist Guide to Crafting Religion, where we go over this thesis that you can think of humans as being sort of two things. Humanity is sort of the evolved firmware we have, which is our like biological predilections, which obviously was shaped by genetic selection pressures. But then on top of that, there were these mimetic packages. And today we often think of mimetic packages as being the things that like infect a person and then motivate that person to infect other people, right? Like we think about them in marketing terms.
Talking about like cultural memes, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But historically, there were these things that we call cultivars. Yeah, they're like cultural memes, where it's like a mix of like a culture and a religion. And this sat on top of the human condition and primarily spread not by converting people, which was actually fairly rare, historically speaking, but by augmenting the fitness of the people that it sat on top of. And when we say fitness, to be clear, we don't mean quality of life. We do not mean, you know, fitness is morally blind. We just mean number of surviving offspring they had that stayed in the same culture. And this was sort of like, if you think of the firmware, like these genetic proclivities humans have as being like a lower level coding level language, this is like the object-oriented coding language that can undergo much faster evolution. And it allowed things like, you know, if you look at Islam or Judaism, like both of them culturally evolved the knowledge that you hand washing like links its life and is a good thing to do literally centuries before, you know, like Lister and science came to the same conclusion. And every one of these cultural groups is sort of like its own organism or like iteration of humanity. Modernity is a new one of these cultural groups, and it better eats away at the immune systems of some of these older groups than others of these older groups. It appears to encounter more immune variants in the Christian and Jewish communities than it does in other communities. It is difficult for me to hypothesize why that's the case. If I had to guess, It is because the iteration of modernity that is leading to lower birth rates uses prosperity to lure people into it, and Christian and Jewish groups have been exposed to this type of post-developing world prosperity for longer than other population clusters. And this explains why, if you look at different variants, like if you look at Catholic groups that are in the U.S. and have been in the U.S. for a long time, they seem currently more resistant to changes in this birth rate collapse than Catholic groups coming from Latin American countries, where this level of prosperity hasn't existed for a long time, and you see birth rates crashing at much faster rates. So I don't think it's anything intrinsic about Christianity or Jewish justice that has been exposed to prosperity for longer and in larger population samples.
Okay, so let me make sure I get the overarching view that you have here. So it sounds to me like you're saying that poverty and belief in that women shouldn't be educated equally to men are both correlated with high birth rates, but modernity tends to lower birth rates as it spreads around the world. These like idea, these modern ideas, or whatever we want to call this set of ideas. But you're saying that as modernity spreads around the world, these like modern views, when it reaches populations that are Christian and Jewish, it tends to have less effect on their birth rates than it does on other populations. Is that what you're claiming?
That's what we're saying. And we're saying that the reason that probably is if you think of like modernity as being like an antibiotic or something, it's just that those population groups have had more exposure to that antibiotic over a longer period of history.
Okay, I think I understand your claims now. So I was just looking up what the countries with the highest birth rate in the world are. And according to this list I found, it's Niger, which I think is almost entirely Muslim. Angola, which I think is mainly a Christian country, I believe. Then there's Mali, which I believe also is Muslim. And then Uganda, which I think is more Christian, if I'm not mistaken. So it's kind of seems like a mix, yeah.
Yeah, all of those countries have high rates of low female education and high rates of poverty, which no matter what leads to a high birth rate. So what we are looking at trying to do is prepare the world for a state in which the entire world has reached a certain level of development and like baseline prosperity, where those countries, presumably, unless there's something very unique about them, are also going to have their birth rate collapse as they undergo the natural cycle that all, you know, the rest of the world is going through of development, getting more female education in their country and getting more wealth into their countries. Even if you take a developed country and ban female education and a portion of it, birth rates will shoot up.
Okay, so going back to my question from before, you know, let's suppose that we could project forward based on the current data and that procedure is valid, which it may not be, but let's suppose we could. What are we predicting the world will be like in 2100?
So the big thing that's going to change that a lot of people are underselling, and a lot of people are like, why do you care so much about birth rates crashing in developed countries? Like, that seems suspicious. It's almost like you care about these developed countries more than other countries. And it's like, well, like it or not, developed countries by their nature are the core source of the world's economy right now. The vast majority of global wealth is in developed countries. And these countries have all sort of built themselves as pyramid schemes that rely on constant growth to stay functional. In average, for the past 300 years in most developed countries, if you put money on the stock market, that money would grow on average. And that happened because the number of workers in those economies was growing exponentially, and the productivity per worker in those economies was growing linearly. And a lot of people make the mistake. They think that because technology has been growing exponentially, that means that the productivity impact it has been exponential as well, when it appears it's mostly been linear.
Let's unpack that for a second, because I thought productivity was usually like a percentage each year. Because if it was a percentage each year, like if productivity went up 1% a year, that would be exponential. But you're saying it's not? You're saying it's more like...
It's not, or it looks linear when contrasted with population growth numbers historically. Like, there is an exponential component to it, but it is linear in contrast to the effect of birth rate on the economic productivity increase of a country.
Okay, so I think the way I interpret that is that even an exponential, if it's a very slow exponential, will kind of look linear relative to a faster exponential. And that's kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah. And we're about to see population begin to decline exponentially if the countries that are more advanced, And where we get this exponential decline from is a lot of people were like, oh, you know, fertility rates aren't that low yet in the US or whatever, right? But keep in mind, the fertility rate is the exponent by which it's declining. And it doesn't appear that this has a floor in the countries where it has declined already, like Korea.
So how much collapse in population has Korea seen?
So, I mean, it's just at the beginning. But as we said, we're looking, you know, for every 100 Koreans, like 4.3 to like 6.4 great-grandchildren at this point. And it's still going down. And this is a fast process. Korea was where we were in the 90s, where we are today. So I can actually run over the math here, okay? So the fertility rate in Korea is either 0.81 or 0.7. At 0.81, that means for every 100 South Koreans, there will be 6.6 great-grandkids. At 0.7, that means for every 100 Koreans, there will be 4.3 great-grandkids. I think a lot of people, when you're dealing with exponents like this, they don't realize how fast things are going to drop. The problem for this happening to developed countries is all of these countries are heavily leveraged. That means they've taken out debt at every level of their society, from their land to their municipalities, to their cities, to their states, to their nation states. And anyone who has run a company knows debt is an amazing tool when things are growing. It multiplies the returns you get. But if things ever shrink, it multiplies the pain and it leads to collapse.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying that basically many of these modern economies are predicated on growth. Most of that growth comes from population growth or immigration, not from productivity growth. And because a society is so levered, if population starts going the other way, that suddenly things will shrink extremely fast. Is that the basic argument?
Yes. And we will start to see most developed economies collapse, which is not good for anyone in the world.
Got it. So is your primary concern then an economic concern rather than a cultural concern?
Our primary concern is a manifold concern.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we don't want there to be a hard landing on demographic collapse. We want there to be a soft landing. And we want people to prepare for the inevitable changes that will take place when population starts leveling off in different areas. And that could be at the city level, and that could be at the nation level, that could be for cultures. So there need to be governmental infrastructure-wise, culture-wise approaches that are taken very consciously, or there could be really negative consequences.
The problem with the economic side of this is as soon as it becomes blindingly obvious to people and they can't keep ignoring how bad this situation is, the economic collapse it instigates will make it impossible to fix, or impossible to fix in sort of any organized fashion. And the homogenization that we will see because of it becomes an inevitability.
So how soon do you project that we will see kind of substantial effects from this?
Within our lifetimes. I think China's the first place we're going to see this. It's funny, you know, a lot of people, they attack us for this. They're like, oh, so you want to like pressure women to have kids? And it's like, no, we want to like change culture to emotionally reward women for having kids and make it a desirable thing to do before we end up in a situation like China where, you know, the government's starting to genuinely pressure women to have kids. And that's what we're going to begin to see, starting with the more authoritarian countries, where we will begin to see like literal handmade tale mirroring stuff, I would predict within the next 25 years.
A recent article on pronatalism that actually came out today had one of the antinatalist nonprofits argue that the quote-unquote alarmism that groups like ours are trying to raise around pronatalism are a form of coercive action trying to get women to have children. And that same article also made note that many vasectomy clinics in China have been closed down and access to birth control is now being made a little more restricted. And that's only just the beginning of what could happen in terms of coercive action around women having children. So, I mean, proactive approaches to a pronatalist world in which women are not robbed of their reproductive rights is kind of important to us. As much as people want to accuse us of being coercive, we actually want to defend reproductive rights. And we also don't want anyone who doesn't want to have kids to have kids. To a great extent, we really just want to help families that want to have a lot of kids have more kids, which is more difficult now than it should be.
So my understanding with regard to China is that the one-child policy, which they implemented in order to try to curb population growth, has now put them in this position where they have a lot of elderly people, and obviously every year they're getting older, and not many young people. Is that right?
This is what we talk about when we talk about the misunderstanding of what's really happening. That is a mischaracterization of what's happening. Their birth rate, they have been trying for about a decade at this point to be able to get their birth rate up with things like the Three China policy and stuff like that. And despite all of their best efforts to get their population rate back up, it is continuing to decline. It's continuing to decline so quickly that year over year this last year, China's fertility rate fell 13%. China's fertility rate now is lower than it was during the Great Famine of like the 1960s, where I think like 6 million people died. It's not that China has a fertility problem just because of the one-child policy. It's worse now than it was then.
But truly that must have contributed to the situation they're in now.
Oh, no, it contributed to the situation, but I mean to act like it's not this larger sort of modernity contingent that's lowering birth rates there as well as everywhere else, I think sort of hides the problem by pretending, oh, it was this one-child policy, and they're not doing it anymore, and after they lifted the one-child policy, their birth rate problem disappeared. That is not the case. And if the one-child policy was what was so effective at lowering their birth rate, you know, why do we see things like Iran's birth rate in the past 30 years collapsing faster than the one-child policy causes China's birth rate to collapse? Why is China unable to, if they were so good at a state level preventing people from having kids, why are they at a state level somehow unable to stem the tide of fertility collapse right now? I think that that's just a narrative that hides the larger picture.
Are you facing a tough or important life decision? Then you should try using Clearer Thinking's Decision Advisor tool to make it easier. With this tool, you won't have to stress as much about those big life decisions. The Decision Advisor can walk you through even the most complicated situations in minutes, so you can come out on the other side with a better idea of what to do. To use the free Decision Advisor tool, or to find Clearer Thinking's other free tools and mini courses, head to clearerthinking.org.
So if we consider this package of ideas we're calling modernity, which we're giving it a really loose name here, obviously, what about it is causing people to have fewer kids?
Well, a lot of it comes down to kids are hard, right? Especially after you have maybe two kids, it is difficult. And maybe from a hedonic perspective, studies show you take a hit happiness-wise, maybe not contentment-wise, but in many forms of happiness and convenience. So if you don't have an exogenous motivator encouraging you to have kids, and especially if you don't have a cultural reason to have kids, and you see this in the nihilism that spread throughout younger generations in China, be it like the lying down movement or people saying we are the last generation, you know, there really isn't this desire to create a next generation. And there is just much more interest in immediate personal comfort and in intra-generational well-being versus intergenerational well-being. So we think largely it's a problem of culture. If you have a culture that is primarily focused around reduction in suffering among oneself or in current populations, you're going to see lower birth rates.
Which is the goal of most modern, I mean, that's the woke goal, like reduce suffering, this form of negative utilitarianism, which doesn't really, it's where you're getting these antinatalist movements from.
Wait, so you see this connected to social justice as an idea?
No. It's just one facet of it. But the social justice is just sort of the id of modernity. You know, it's the quiet part out loud. It's the promise that we will remove emotional pain. And I think that most people who sort of grow up in modernity, if you're like, well, what's the good? What should society aim for? And it's remove pain, not maximize pleasure. Or not maximize beauty or anything like that. And that just doesn't really motivate a high birth rate. But interestingly, I mean, I think to get people to think about what you need to have a healthy culture. So if you have any population group, and when I say population group, I mean, think of like your friends who live in a city or whatever, right? Like just any of your listeners, think of your friend group. If a third of that friend group is having no kids or isn't going to have any kids, and a third of that friend group is having two kids, whatever sociological profile or belief system is associated with that friend group, for that to stay stable in the population, the final third has to have over 4 kids. And our society is just not set up in a way where you can have a huge chunk of people having over 4 kids, and people aren't really rewarded or motivated to have over 4 kids at large numbers. And that's really the population that you need to target and enable to fix low birth rates. It's not convincing the people who want to have 2 kids to have more than 2 kids. It's not convincing the people who want to have no kids to have kids. It's convincing the people who want to have 4 kids to have 7 kids. That's where this is fixed, and that requires a cultural fix. And this is why we keep going back to things like these older religious structures that our society has cast off. It turns out that humans evolutionarily had sort of been using these as a crutch to motivate birth rates. And now that we have shed them, we don't have anything that motivates birth rates anymore. And we're going to see the portion of the population that was like sociologically susceptible to shedding them essentially being deleted from the human gene pool.
So when I think about like the trade-off of having kids, I think of it as partly a trade-off of pleasure for meaning. Like I think that, well, I think some people really, really get lots of pleasure from being around kids. But I think a lot of people, they don't necessarily find it that pleasurable, but they do increase their sense of meaning in life. And I did at one point in my life a bunch of interviews with parents, and I found it really fascinating because I would ask them questions like, what is the kind of best moment with your children? And I remember this one couple I was talking to, very high achievers. They work really hard and they have a nanny while they're gone, and they come home in the evening and they take care of their kids in the evening. And I was sitting with this couple and they said, oh yeah, the best moment is right after we've tucked them into bed and we're just watching their sleeping faces and just thinking about how great they are. And I was like, that is a very interesting choice of greatest moment, because your kid is literally unconscious at that moment. And so I thought that was really, really fascinating. But I don't know how representative that is, but I do get the sense that there is that kind of pleasure meaning trade-off. And I'm curious what you think of that.
That's really interesting. I do think that there is a lot more meaning. Like that is it's like serotonin versus dopamine that you're getting, you know? And it's, I think the just after they went to sleep moment resonates. But I think, it comes back to culture and it comes back to the way that you contextualize meaning and what winning means in life. And our current culture just doesn't contextualize that life, which can be very exhausting, as being a form of winning.
Keep in mind that if you look at surveys among like Gen Z, right, like a quarter of them plan to not have kids for like environmental reasons, for example. We are actively trained by our culture that kids are a source of negative meaning, that they rob the world and life of meaning. We are told this as we are growing up. And I think you can look at people who have kids whose biological sort of systems have kicked into place after having kids, and they then see those kids as a source of meaning. But I think, when you look at why people have their first kid, their second kid, like why they have each incremental kid, I don't think people do that to inject their lives with meaning. And I would say that that's a really bad reason to tell someone to have kids, that seems like it's going to lead to a lot of negative externalities. The primary reason people have each incremental kid is cultural mandates, largely speaking.
Okay, so without those cultural mandates, right, why should someone have, more than 2 kids?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's so many. I mean, this sounds weird that we're saying kids make life harder and they're more stressful. And yet Malcolm and I, after having our third kid, are already so excited about starting with a fourth. Just seeing our children, seeing them grow. It is hard to understate just how wonderful these kids are and how much we learn from them and how much happiness and joy they do bring to our lives. But Malcolm, what were you going to say?
But that's a hedonic argument. I think he means in like an absolute sense the value of kids. And it's that if everyone who is susceptible to what we think of as modernity, like a world with prosperity and female education and everything like that, and being open to outside ideas and being open to outside groups, if that entire population stops having kids, then the people who are susceptible to those ideas at a sociological level, if you look at things like voting patterns, if you look at things like altruism, pro-sociality, all of these things have a large heritable component. And, if you go and you hunt elephants and you hunt the elephants with the big tusks and that aren't afraid of people, then the elephants get small tusks and they start becoming afraid of people. having like skittishness or different ways of seeing the world have a heretical component isn't unique to animals. Humans have that as well. And if you systemically delete all of the humans who are open to ideas like environmentalism from the population, you will see that at lower rates within future populations. And while genetics may not be a good determinant of the way any specific individual is going to turn out, they can be really predictive at the population level. And by that, what I mean is, if you look at like a polygenic risk score as being something like, okay, I have a sheet of paper and there is a 60% chance that it'll have a blue dot under it. You know, I don't know much better than chance whether that paper is going to have a blue dot under it. But if I know that there are 1,000 pieces of paper and all of them have a 60% chance of having a blue dot under it, I can tell you with a high degree of certainty, you know, what percent of all of those 1,000 pieces of paper are going to have a blue dot under them and how many blue dots there are going to be. And this matters when you're talking about things like democracy and sort of mass action in society. So we are going to see shifts in humanity, some for the better, I think. Maybe a drive to more religiosity is going to make humanity a more robust and kinder species, but some for the worse, potentially. And when we think about what we're trying to do with our family, I mean, largely we like many of the things that we associate with modernity, like equality, being open to outside ideas, female education, technophilia, you know, like being open to technology. And we believe and want to fight for, you know, a diverse, hopefully one day intergalactic human civilization. And to do that, we have to, through our own family and the culture we build for it, show that it is possible to motivate families in those circumstances to have a lot of kids. What is great about this problem is highly tractable. You know, one of the things we get most maligned about is we're like, look, just look at the math here, right? If just our family has 8 kids and they have 8 kids and you do this for 11 generations, that means we have more descendants than there are people on Earth today. Now, as should be obvious from what we're saying, homogenization is a big fear of ours in society. The reason we point this out is we don't need everybody to go along with this. We just need enough families to build durable cultures that our kids get to live in like a diverse social ecosystem that at least to some extent mirrors our own.
To build on what Malcolm says, there's an issue in which people like Scott Alexander, for example, when arguing as to why they're not so concerned about demographic collapse, often argue things like, well, we're very strong in terms of converting people to our culture, you know, be that progressive values or technophilia or whatever it is that you care about, environmentalism, women's rights. The problem is that if you continue to poach from other cultures that are having, like if you take their children and convert them, and that's how you keep your population stable, your culture stable, you're going to, especially if you, when you convert them, cause them to not have children, you are basically, we'll say, infecting certain people you convert with a sterilizing meme and causing them to get removed from the gene pool. That means that the people that will exist in the future, that ultimately will survive in future generations, are going to be more resistant to outside ideas. They're going to be more resistant to conversion and therefore sterilization. And so to just rely on converting people to maintain your culture is inherently unsustainable and still likely to lead your culture to become extinct, your values to disappear.
Yeah, and I should be clear, this is actually where data that you collected, Spencer, was really important to making us such firebrands about this, that I think you probably remember when we first went to you with this data, and we considered it something of a lark at the time. We're like, oh, you did this big study on political affiliations, and it happened to record how many kids we're having. And so it was just like this absolutely massive data set, and we paid Mohammed, a researcher at Mayo Clinic, to go through it. What we found is what ended up making us such firebrands on this topic is we had assumed going into it that it was religiosity that was protecting people from birth rate collapse. And we assumed this because it was these more traditional sort of mimetic organism-like clusters that were able to motivate birth rate in face of modernity. And what we learned is that assumption was wrong. Now, religiosity is highly heritable. But what it turns out is that being at a higher end of religiosity within one of these traditional cultures doesn't really predict whether or not you will deconvert from that culture. And this is something I should have known. Like, I am familiar with the atheist community. Everyone knows that the people who convert most out of religions into the atheist community are often the most fervent, the most fire-branded people before their deconversion. And anybody who looks at, like, wokeism or ultra-progressivism sees this religiosity, like, instinct in some of these people. It turns out that it's not this sociological profile of religiosity that protects people in these traditional cultures that motivate high birth rate. It's another population cluster, which is called the far-right authoritarian population cluster, which basically is just the instinct to dehumanize anyone who's from your outgroup. Now, I should be clear here, it was named the far-right population authoritarian population cluster by progressive academics. It actually appears almost as frequently in far-leftist groups. I mean, it's the same thing that motivates people to, like, join Antifa and stuff like that. It just means this sort of instinctive desire to dehumanize and not listen to anyone who's different from you.
You're saying that trait is especially correlated with high birth rates?
Yes, that's what's protecting people, and that's what is most correlated with high birth rates. But I mean, even outside of that, I mean, I think we should be honest with our, and it is heritable. There's been studies showing that it has a big heritable component. If we look more broadly at our culture, like, are we, and I don't really consider myself part of this modern culture. I consider myself as being much closer in mindset and sensibilities to these more traditional religious cultures. I mean, that's why we call ourselves secular Calvinists and not, like, I don't know, modern secular people. But to me, it just seems sort of perverse that sort of this modern culture could just be happy parasitizing other families and converting kids out of these traditional ways of life and homogenizing them. It just seems, I don't know, morbid.
Okay, so you're saying that there's this particular authoritarian kind of, like, dislike the outgroup trait that's linked to having high birth rates, but presumably you don't want to spread that, like, the outgroup is bad meme, right? So then what is your strategy? How do you...
Well, that's what's going on in society right now. That's what happens, you know, if we can't find a way within our own family and with other, you know, I guess sort of families like us motivate high birth rates. And what we're trying to do, and this is what we try to do with the book, The Pragmatist Guide to Crafting Religion, is sort of think about the evolution of these older cultural units. Think about what our society threw out as we secularized and think about how we can go back and sort of restructure many of these older religious systems. And I think as a society, we're increasingly learning how much of what we threw out had value. You know, as society secularized, we're like, oh, all of these arbitrary rules, let's get rid of them. And, you know, you look at any religion, whether it's like Ramadan or Feast of the Firstborn or Lent, you know, you have these arbitrary self-denial rituals. And now we're learning, oh, those are important. And so, you know, you have in the modern secular world all these, like, fasting crazes and everything like that. But that wasn't the only thing of value that we threw out. I would argue, and what we argue in the book is most of what we threw out was valuable.
But what we're trying to say is what we're avoiding with a hard landing on demographic collapse is a small number of cultures, more close to a cultural monoculture, of cultures that are closed-minded, more totalitarian, not willing to, you know, embrace a lot of progressive values or consider outside views. We want to prove that you can have a high birth rate, you can perpetuate a culture into the far distant future while still being open-minded, while still being open to innovation, while still being pluralistic and willing to engage with other cultures, learn from them, adapt, and protect things like women's rights.
And I think that more broadly here, anyone who's listening to your podcast is probably thinking about AI, right? Is AI just going to kill us all? Is AI a deus ex machina, right? And AI is a really interesting wild card here. And it is not one that we are discounting. When we look at AI right now and we're saying, what's the probability AI kills us all within, you know, the next 150 years? I'd say that probability is a good 20-25%. Like, that's big, right? What is the probability that our society enters a terrifying dark age? Because we've gone through these cycles before, you know, whether you're looking at Athens or the Renaissance or Rome, you know, of sort of a golden age of, you know, being open to other lifestyles, being open to other ideas of flourishing of science, and then dark ages afterwards. But we've never hit one of these dark ages with nukes. And the probability that we are heading towards one of these dark ages, I'd say 99%. So yes, AI is very dangerous and very scary, but if we somehow dodge AI killing us all, we are driving straight into a wall right now. And there's just no way around it in the data that I can see.
So unpack the dark age claim. So you're saying we're going to have demographic collapse, and then how does that lead to a dark age?
So it leads to economic collapse, and it leads to shifting in what sort of the human profile was. So there's an interesting study that's going to be coming out soon that was looking at polygenic risk scores associated with education. You know, and you can look at this, and this is like a well-studied thing. You can, they actually determine polygenic risk scores associated with education currently are so accurate that they can determine, you know, a person's educational attainment level at a higher rate than an IQ test can.
So this is, they look at across someone's whole genome and they build like a regression model trying to use sort of all the genes simultaneously to predict something about them, right? That's what you're talking about here?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we can look at these in bodies. We can look at these in bodies of people during the Roman Republic era, during the height of the Roman Empire, and after the Roman Empire, and see how their rates of expression changed over time.
Like digging up old DNA, you're saying?
Yeah, and a study's about to come out that's going to show this, and it shows in the Republic era, like before the empire, like right as it was beginning to explode, the polygenic risk scores that today are associated with high educational attainment were uniquely high in that population cluster to the extent that they were even higher then than they are in the modern Roman population cluster. They then fell a lot as the empire grew to its height, and then they rose again during the Dark Age, you know, preparing civilization for a next height. These civilizational cycles are something we've gone through before, and we can see it happening again. If you look at the polygenic risk scores associated with educational attainment in modern developed countries, there was a great study of this, I want to say, in like Iceland or something. So people are like, oh, it's a coincidence that, you know, IQ seems to be dropping like 0.2 points a year. But the actual polygenic risk scores associated with educational attainment are directly associated with lower birth rates. They directly negatively impact the fitness of people. The same scores that predict a person's educational attainment also predict how many kids they will have.
So why would this lead to dark age rather than, say, something more like what we saw in Japan, right? My understanding is that, you know, the Japanese stock market was kind of flat for a really long time. We also had a declining population in Japan, I think, for quite a while. But it's not like a dark age, right? It's sort of,
I mean, and it's still declining.
Right, but you know what I'm saying? Like, basically, you know, you wouldn't call Japan a dark age. You'd say...
I'd say look at how much debt Japan is under right now. They're only able to maintain a debt structure like that because... And that debt is necessary for their economy to function because the rest of the world is still functioning basically okay, and they're part of global supply chains. If every country was like Japan, the economy just wouldn't function.
So what do you see would happen? Like, can you try to be a little more specific? Obviously, it's hard to predict the future, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, so it'll look like the fall of the Roman Empire. So I think a lot of people, when they think of like a collapsing civilization, they think of like Road Warrior, and that's not really what it looks like. You know, if you're in like Roman Gaul during the collapse of the Roman Empire, what it looks like is like supply chains break down, some stuff that used to be in your grocery store start disappearing, some social programs that people in your community, the most vulnerable people, used to rely on, they slowly start disappearing or become less effective because money's worth less. Infrastructure stops being updated as much. You know, your aqueduct stops working 1 year, your fresh water supply stops coming into town. You start to hear of rich people in your community losing all your money, but you don't really care because you're a subsistence farmer anyway. I just think that when people hear about civilizational collapses, they expect it to be much more dramatic. The problem is that the people who get most impacted by civilizational collapses are often the people who are sort of running these governments. And these are the people who in the current era have nukes. And that is what scares me.
So you're worried about sort of decline in civilization leading to nuclear war, basically?
Increased conflict, deglobalization. Now, deglobalization is probably a good thing. I think it was a mistake that we became as globalized as we did. But a rapid deglobalization is going to hurt economics. And in a world where people look down on outgroups at like an intrinsic level, that's going to lead to more conflict. And so that combined with deglobalization and potential like resources becoming more scarce, that's going to have all sorts of negative effects that could increase the amount of conflict we see in the world in really negative ways that is very worrying to me.
Have you ever wondered if you have what it takes to be the founder or CEO of a successful startup? It takes a wide range of skills to run a successful business. Fortunately, Clearer Thinking has developed a quiz to help you determine if you have what it takes to start your own company. They've assembled the wisdom of some of the world's most experienced entrepreneurs and venture capitalists, gurus who have started multiple companies themselves or advised hundreds of companies. And that compiled wisdom includes information about the most important traits and skills that must be embodied in top entrepreneurs to achieve startup success. They then boiled all of that down into a simple quiz that you can take for free. Take the quiz to find out how well your personality and skills are suited to founding a startup, how much you know about starting a successful company, which famous startup CEO you're most like, what your greatest strengths and weaknesses are, what to look for in a co-founder, and what areas you could work on to improve your chance of success. To find the entrepreneur test, along with many other tools and mini courses, go to clearerthinking.org.
So what would show that you were wrong? Like, let's say, you know, 30 years from now, what would be a sign that you're incorrect?
Yeah, no, easy. An immediate thing that could show I'm wrong. Some country finds a way to get their birth rate back up significantly. Like Korea finds a way to turn it around. China, without doing something coercive, finds a way to turn it around. If anyone finds a way to significantly turn it around, that would be huge, but no one has yet. You look at like Hungary, they spent 5% of their GDP last year trying to get their fertility rate up, and they got it up by like 1.6%. You know, consider that China's fertility rate is declining like 13% year over year last year. Like, so there was a great study done that showed that if you looked at the studies that were determining whether cash handouts had a positive impact on fertility, how much they showed they had a positive impact was directly correlated to the margin of error of that study. So it really does appear that you can't, like cash handouts don't fix this. It appears to need to be a cultural solution and a solution at the level of individual families who build sorts of new intergenerationally durable cultures for themselves, while also state-level governments removing some of the restrictions that make it very difficult for families to have over 3 or 4 kids.
What are some of those restrictions?
Yeah, there's a lot of, I would say Zvi Moshowitz has a really good blog post about this. I think it's called something along the lines of car seats as contraception. It is incredibly thorough and incredibly compelling. But it talks about how things like a lot of government policies that are meant to protect children, you know, that are very, very well-intentioned, ultimately make it really hard as a parent to have more than 2 or 3 kids. And also, I would say that there's a lot more government intervention on raising, schooling, caring for children than there has been in the past. We've seen more instances than ever of child protective services being called on parents after their kids are seen walking home from school or walking home from a park just for 2 blocks. So there is just a lot being placed on parents that is entirely unreasonable by governments. And by just removing some basic unreasonable standards, I think it will make it a lot easier for families to have and raise kids.
So right now, thousands of people are going to be listening to you talk about this. And most of these people don't have kids or don't have kids yet. So what would you say to them? You know, now's your moment to try to convince them to have children if you want. What would you say to them?
I would not say just go out and have kids. I would say, do you want to engage in this project? This project of with your family and with your kids? Because if you just go out there and you just spam lots of kids, like suppose you are not doing any good. You know, you need to rebuild what it was that motivated people to have lots of kids in the past. And that is intergenerationally durable culture. That is a cultural identity where your kids will know what it means to be a member of your family, how your family is different than other people, and why they should have kids themselves. And actually, I think this is a big reason why, for example, Jewish groups have been so resistant to population collapse, is they have done a very good job of conveying this to their kids. Even when their family secularized, they still very much know who they are, what their identity is, and why it matters to be part of their cultural group, and why their cultural group has value.
There's also another factor to this. I think it's really important, one, to only have kids if you feel like you are able to, if you have a group of friends or a partner that you feel like you can raise kids with successfully. But then a lot of people are in a position where they could do that and they don't think they should because it would dampen their ability to have an impactful career. But when you think about the amount of impact you can have by, to Malcolm's point, building a durable culture that your children in turn pass on, the impact is incredible. And I think people also don't think about the extent to which children can hedge their philosophical bets. So think about anything that you can achieve with your career, even if you are wildly successful, your influence will largely end with your death. And maybe the entire ideology that you used, you know, the evidence that you utilized to make your decisions on what you're going to fight for was off or inaccurate. So your entire life, even if very impactful, even if very influential, may have been kind of moving in the wrong direction or a feckless direction because your evidence was insufficient and you weren't actually doing what was ideal or best per your values. If you have children, you sort of get another roll of the dice. You get another generation to try it. Your children are going to watch you as you work throughout your career. They're going to grow up exposed to your culture and your ideology, and they will also be exposed to different and perhaps better evidence. So they get to, you basically get to spend their entire upbringing as a sales pitch for your values and your culture. And if ultimately that sales pitch fails, your children may pursue something different. And I think that's a really great thing. We're also not saying that you have to have kids so you indoctrinate them and force them to live your values. To a great extent, you have kids to have another shot at trying life an entirely different way through those children when they make their own decisions and choose to have their own impact in the world. And if you have children who in turn have children, who in turn have children, you have generations of people who can have a huge impact on the future of humanity, our ability to overcome great challenges, our ability to flourish as a species, go to other planets. It's kind of hard to imagine anything that you can do in your career that would be more impactful than that. So even though sometimes having children can be a little bit of a dampener or a headwind on your career or make your career a little bit more difficult, the impact that you will ultimately have if you raise them successfully, if you give them a good upbringing, if you give them the best education you possibly can, is pretty incredible. So just like from a, you could argue, effective altruism angle, or just from a having a maximum impact per your values angle, I think kids are pretty impactful, and that's my pitch.
So before we wrap up, let's talk about kind of designing a culture, right? Because essentially, your pitch is around having a culture in your family that can propagate throughout time. And so what does that look like? I know that you have taken this topic on in one of your new books.
Yeah. So the theological framework for our culture that we raise our kids with is we sort of, you know, ask them, you know, 10 million years from now, if their descendants are still alive, would those descendants be more the way they conceptualize a human today or closer to the way they conceptualize a god today? And I think most people, if you're talking 10 million years of technological advancement in the future, you know, whatever we end up changing about humanity in the future, they're probably going to be closer to the way we would conceptualize a god today. And who's to say our understanding of physics is complete? Who's to say that these distant future beings, in the same way that like in the double slit experiment, we can see probability waves bounce off each other, don't exist as sort of a probability wave almost attempting to manifest themselves, and that they cannot influence, that they're not watching over us today, that they're not watching over our kids today, and rewarding them for making decisions that ensure a prosperous future for our species. And in many ways, you know, we joke that this is sort of like descendant worship. You know, so many cultures have a form of ancestor worship where they're like, in the aggregate, their ancestors are watching over them and guiding them. And we try to really make this a forward and future focused thing that gives our kids and ourselves motivation to give our kids the best lives possible. Our kids do not exist to serve us and their ancestors as they do in many other cultures. Our kids exist to serve their descendants. Simone, could you talk a bit about our holidays sort of that we've designed around this? And
yeah, so the larger point, and one thing, a point we're trying to make with holidays that we have invented for our own family, is that even if you are secular, it's important to create more of a cohesive culture, a feeling of belonging, feelings of like tradition and fun things to impart fitness both within any participant's life, but also that encourage people to have kids, raise their kids in that culture, and then inspire those children to in turn raise their own kids in that culture. So having this cohesive set of holidays, traditions, things that you enjoy that are kind of related to a larger metaphysical understanding of the world, even if it's secular, is really valuable. So to Malcolm's point about our belief that, you know, far distant descendants will be akin to gods, we talk a lot about the future police. Like if something bad happens in your life, because we have this deterministic approach to the world, we're like, well, you know, maybe, you know, the future police orchestrated this. So one thing that we often do is if something bad happens in our lives, we often, per our metaphysical understanding of the world, we say, well, hey, maybe the future police made that happen. This was meant to happen. And we also, to Malcolm's point, have a holiday where we really play with the concept of the future police while also leveraging trends associated with other holidays. So right around New Year's, we do Future Police Day, where leading up to New Year's Eve, the future police steal from our children some Skinner box related device. So anything that's kind of related to operant conditioning, kind of causing them to become addicted to something. It could be a mobile game. It could be any number of things, you know, that we steal from them, possibly a gaming console, most likely gaming consoles, let's be honest here. And then we leave a little calling card from the future police saying, you know, we've taken this from you, because to a great extent, those devices are removing their efficacy as humans. Then they need to pledge to the future police. They basically write down a vision they have for the future, how they're going to make it better, and one specific discrete thing they will do that year to help to make that future come to pass. They place that note, that promise, that contract, essentially, in a designated location that could plausibly last for thousands of years, you know, be found by the future police in the future. And, oh, Titan's waking up. And so if the future police are pleased with the pledge made by the children, they return the addictive object along with a small gift and then give them a later gift later in the year if they achieve their proposed project. And the gift, of course, will be in proportion to however challenging the project was.
So the goal of this holiday is to, one, get the kids thinking a lot about the future that they want to see in the world, but also to make them understand that they have agency about the future. If you look at Gen Z right now, there's just so much nihilism. We really want our kids to grow up feeling like they have agency over the distant future, that their actions matter, and that they can work to create a better and brighter future for our species. And, you know, you might have noticed, she mentioned our kid Titan Invictus in the background there. And a lot of people online, you know, they're always making fun of us for the names we name our kids. But that is what it means to be a distinct culture. Any predominant culture, the predominant culture that's one within our social ecosystem, partially one because it was very good. It had an immune system that was very good at stamping out any deviant culture, any cultural variance, by calling them cringe, by calling them weird, you know, by calling them nerds or whatever. And so by owning that cringe or that difference about your culture and saying, no, this is who we are, and we are okay with being different from the mainstream culture, because the mainstream culture isn't motivating high birth rates, it's not motivating vitality, and frankly, it doesn't seem very nice to live in. We can, both through the traditions that the kids grow up with and the way they self-identify as people with hopefully feeling like they have agency over the future, carry this on to the next generation. And if they don't want to carry this on to the next generation, we've even built this separate thing that we call the index, which is a way to bring them back in and keep them. If they say, look, I think I can do it better than my parents, I think I can build a better culture than the one my parents built, we actually love that idea and we would want our kids to do that. So they just record the traditions that their parents had them practice, the outcomes of those traditions in the central index, and then they get to try their own variation. And then when their kids get married, they then get to review the index and the outcomes of the various traditions to determine if they want to spin the dice again. Think of it like cultural horizontal gene transfer that can hopefully allow for a faster transmission of sort of cultural resistances to changes in this sort of larger modernity, like super virus, which is eating away at most of the more traditional cultures in the world.
So for final thoughts, what would you say to parents who want to create their own culture? What would your advice be to them?
We spent the past like 3 years writing a book to help you, The Pragmatist Guide to Crafting Religion. I really nothing else I can say. Check out the book.
Well, but beyond that, I would say basically you don't have to be religious in a traditional sense to create a very compelling culture and religion. It can be really fun to develop entirely new traditions that take the best of what old religious traditions offered and the best of what new science explains. So, you know, there are many strange old religious traditions around fasting or food prohibitions or coming of age ceremonies that kind of now make sense because of science. You can really now parse out the stuff that's ridiculous and that you can get rid of that don't really help anyone, and things that science really reinforces and, you know, that show to really help people mentally and give them an advantage in life. And I think it's really fun to parse out, I'm sorry, Titan wants to join in. It's fun to really parse out those similarities and build something that's very intelligent.
Yeah, and I would really argue that I think that people should, what we want for a future is a diverse future. We don't want people to just like borrow everything that we've created for our family, which we call like secular covenant because it draws a lot on our family's like older traditions, but riff on their own traditional culture. But also, you know, I think there's just too much animosity in our society against sort of the older religious traditions without understanding the benefits that they provided us, which, I mean, we see from mental health to happiness rates in these more strict religious cultures. And I think we can rebuild iterations of those and develop those that already exist into things that are robust against this cultural supervirus.
Thank you both for coming on. This was a really interesting conversation.
After the discussion, Spencer followed up with Malcolm and Simone to ask some additional questions about their views that he'd felt uncertain about during the episode. First, Spencer pointed out that, according to the UN, the world population is projected to reach 8.5 billion in 2030 and to increase further to 9.7 billion in 2050 and 10.4 billion by 2100. Spencer asked whether Malcolm and Simone expect these estimates to be accurate and how this estimate influences their views. Additionally, Spencer asked when they anticipate seeing the rise of substantial problems in the world as a result of falling birth rates. Malcolm and Simone responded with the following.
We're so glad you brought these things up, as most peers who see this information think, aha, and therefore none of this is a problem, and forgot that the problem we're highlighting is not, hey, we need the global population growing, but rather, wow, populations are dropping locally all over the place. If we don't handle this thoughtfully, we're in for a world of hurt. While the world's population does not start declining until 2064, that is not relevant when the population of almost every developed country in the world is already well below replacement rate. A country is only likely to have an above repopulation birth rate if the average citizen is earning less than $5,000 a year. What about using immigrants to shore up the problem? Here we would ask people to consider what they are really suggesting and the long-term implications of it. Recall that South America, Central America, and the Caribbean have already collectively fallen below repopulation rate. Almost all of the growth we are seeing in the global population is coming from just a few nations in Africa. This growth will hold steady in those countries so long as they are impoverished. It would be very bad to make developed world's economies reliant on ensuring that those countries stay impoverished. We also need to consider it is somewhat sociopathic as people from white Christian and Jewish cultural groups to say fertility collapse is not a problem, given that those groups are the two most resistant cultures in the world to prosperity-induced fertility collapse. Conservative Christians and conservative Jews are the only cultural groups in the entire world that show durable resistance to fertility collapse after their nations get wealthy. These populations drop dramatically less than other cultures, meaning that if we succeed in making the world wealthy, and if current trends hold, the inheritors of our society will largely be conservative Christians and Jews. We encourage people to stop building their worldviews on their far right and far left talking points and just look at the data. Compare Israel's fertility rate with that of Iran. Go through all the policies Iran has implemented over the past decade to try to raise its fertility rate. We are looking at a cultural mass extinction event with cultures like Jains, Parsi, Emiratis, and dozens of Native American groups likely to go extinct in the next century, all while we sit here saying there is no problem because it doesn't affect our people We are killing people's cultures, extinguishing thousands of unique cultural and ethnic groups at a level totally unparalleled when contrasted against anything but the colonial age. And we are asked to act like this mass homogenization of our species into people like us is irrelevant? We believe humankind benefits from cultural and ethnic diversity and see this as an issue worth highlighting, even if our cultural and ethnic group is the single biggest beneficiary of demographic collapse. People use growing global population to hide three core issues at hand here. One, rapid demographic shifts in the developed world will lead to a collapse of the world's current economic system, and we should at the very least be preparing for this as a society. Two, no country in the world outside of maybe Israel has figured out how to have it all. Prosperity, gender equality, and access to education, along with a stable population or economy. We have been able to hide this through the shell game of mass immigration. This should be a problem for anyone who wants a future in which all nations enjoy prosperity, gender equality, and access to education. Three, fertility rates are falling locally within cultural groups around the world, leading to what can only be called cultural mass extinction. This extinction primarily benefits Christian and Jewish groups and is leading to the homogenization of our species. If you want to learn more about this stuff, feel free to check out our books, The Pragmatist's Guide series, or check out our podcast, Based Camp. Not a single nation in the world outside of maybe Israel has figured out how to combine prosperity, gender equality, and access to education with a stable population, and this seems like something we should probably be working on if we're trying to aggressively push these things in every corner of the globe. Stop and let that sink in. Prosperity, gender equality, and access to education appear to be incompatible with a stable society, and we've been hiding this fact by importing people from countries that don't yet have access to these things. If you value a future in which those things still exist, this should be a huge issue to you. The goal of the pronatalist movement is not endless population growth or even a higher world population, but rather awareness of this shell game and alleviation of the effects it will have on society as its impact becomes evident. We must recognize the massive demographic transition we're about to undergo and rejigger the way we fund and leverage infrastructure, pensions, stock markets, and a myriad of other institutions to make them durable in the face of declining populations. The average fertility rate of developed countries is 1.56 right now. That is catastrophically low and getting lower every year. This is not a problem that can be written off just because it is only hitting developed countries. That's where the world economy is. If those countries go down, everyone goes down with them. A lack of development may be what makes national fertility rates high, but a lack of development also makes nations' economies less relevant to the global economy. If this changes, if these countries' economies become stronger, then all data suggests their fertility rates will also crash. Worse, the scale of the problem is hidden if you look at population numbers and not fertility numbers and rates of change in those numbers. From 2010 to 2020, U.S. fertility rates declined by 15.9% and ended the decade at 1.64. If fertility continues to decline at this rate, and a new generation emerges roughly every 30 years, then for every 100 living Americans, there will be 3.7 great-grandkids. The effects of low fertility do not cause a population to crash when they first appear. It takes about one generation for that to happen. Once a majority of a society's population reaches a certain age, there's nothing that society can do to reverse a population collapse. The point of no return is past before that society begins to meaningfully experience a drop in population. To be more specific, a population that is 80% over the age of 50 will likely never be able to recover because people over 50 are very unlikely to have kids, though they often still have about half of their lifespan ahead of them. This is why talking about population numbers instead of fertility rates can obscure the gravity of the population's risk of a hard landing on demographic collapse. So you can't wait until a population numbers actually start to collapse to address this problem, or it's too late, as at that point, most of the population is out of the fertility window. The point of no return for a population, fertility-wise, can happen long before their population actually starts to see a rapid decline. This is a huge issue to anyone who claims to care about gender equality. If we can't find ways to culturally motivate people to solve this voluntarily, the only wealthy cultures to survive, and thus the ones that end up controlling the future of our species, will be those which coerce women to have kids. We want to go on record saying that within the next 15 years, due to its low birth rates, China will either see an economic collapse, not a depression, or implement Handmaid's Tale-like policies. To be fair, most of our concerns are long-term in nature, beyond 2050. Birth rate problems are intrinsically measured in human lifespans. If you wait until the problem can no longer be ignored, it is already too late.
Thanks again for listening. We always love to hear from our listeners, so if you have questions or comments for us, just send us an email at clearerthinkingpodcast@gmail.com. This episode was edited by Ryan Kessler and transcribed by We Amplify. Uri Bram is the podcast's factotum. If you like our show, then we'd really appreciate it if you could rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts and tell your friends about us on social media. We also hope you'll subscribe to our email newsletter called One Helpful Idea. Each week, we'll send you one idea that we think is really valuable that you can read about in just 30 seconds, along with that week's new podcast episodes, an essay by Spencer, and announcements about upcoming events. To sign up for that newsletter or to find show notes, transcripts, and more info about the show, visit podcast.clearerthinking.org. A listener asks, have the ultra-rich irreversibly won? Or are there any viable options for putting a clamp on their power?
It's kind of a strange framing. I mean, if you think about who has power in society, there are different pockets of power, right? A bunch of people who are really powerful are ultra-rich. That's absolutely true. But ultra-rich people are not one group. It's not like they all work together and they all meet together and friends with each other. There are sort of pockets of them, right? So there are libertarian ultra-rich people, you know, some of whom are, let's say, hedge fund managers, or libertarian tech people who have certain things they're trying to get done in society, right? And then there's highly liberal ultra-rich people that are pushing for certain things, maybe opposing Donald Trump. And then there are conservative ultra-rich people that are pushing for certain things. Maybe they're Christian conservatives and they want to go back to a more traditional Christian society, right? And so, you know, I wouldn't view it as a monolith. Fortunately, there are also other powerful groups, right? So while politicians definitely tend to be rich relative to sort of, you know, when they get up to really high-level politics relative to sort of the average person, they're not in the ultra-rich usually. Most of them are not. Obviously, some of them are, but most of them are not. And politicians have a lot of power too. And so that's another group. And it is true that ultra-rich people influence politics, but politicians also are influenced by voters. And so, you know, so it's not like they're fully captured by the ultra-rich, at least as far as I'm aware. I don't believe that's true. There are other pockets of power. You know, journalists are powerful in their own way. Startup founders are powerful in their own way. They can change society through the companies they build. And when they start, they're not ultra-rich, mainly. They're, you know, starting from the ground floor, usually. So yeah, I think there's a lot of different pockets of power in the world, and I don't want to oversimplify.